Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Cryptic, yet confessional. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you. Where you think the cipher come from? The gods. Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 140, a conversation with Beans. Beans is an underground rap legend, best known for his time as a member of the group Antipop Consortium. He grew up in White Plains, New York, and developed a unique abstract, wordy style that made him equally suited to both rap and the thriving New York City spoken word scene of the mid-1990s. Beans teamed up with High Priest, M. Saeed, and producer Earl Blaze to form APC in 1997. They came to public notice with their seminal album Tragic Epilogue in 2000 and followed it up with several other influential and critically beloved releases before splitting up in 2002. Beans kept on releasing solo records while also continuing a career-long habit of collaboration. Over the years, he has worked with the likes of Vernon Reed, DJ Shadow, Ardo Lindsay, and many more. We met up with Beans at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another big player in New York City's 1990s spoken word scene, Raquel Cepeda, on episode 127. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now, here's your favorite anti-popper, Beans. Off mic, you said you got your start at rap meets poetry events that involve one of our frequent guests, Bill Adler.
Yeah, so through Bill Adler and Bob Hoffman from the Narican Poets Cafe, they used to organize these events called Rap Meets Poetry at the Fez underneath the Time Cafe. But that, like, near, closer to, or like around the corner from where other music is now.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like some Korean or Chinese restaurant, mm-hmm. but it used to be like the Time Cafe.
Here Beans is giving us a travelogue of the East Village poetry and music scene. The New Eurekan Poets Cafe is a world-famous poetry club. Fez Under Time Cafe was a club opened from 1992 to 2005 and featured hundreds of diverse artists, including Jeff Buckley, Johnny Cash, and the Jesus and Mary Chain, and that's just a tiny portion of the Jays. Other Music is a well-regarded independent music store in the neighborhood.
Yeah, so in the basement at the Fez, that's how I met like Priest from Antipop. You know, I met a lot of, that's where I met Mike Ladd, actually, who we were also talking about earlier.
Yeah.
I met them at that event.
Nice. And so what was that scene kind of like in New York? Well, first off, what time frame is this?
It was like early 90s. I mean, like the first people I met a lot of people, like a lot of poets who were doing their thing. Like I met like Greg Tate there, like, you know, Tracy Morris, you know, Sapphire came in and did a couple of things.
Greg Tate is a writer, musician, and producer, and The Source called him one of the godfathers of hip-hop journalism. He also co-founded Black Rock Coalition with Vernon Reed and others, a New York-based artist collective and nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the creative freedom and works of black musicians. Tracy Morris is an award-winning poet, performer, vocalist, and academic, and has performed on MTV's Spoken Word Unplugged. She's also a Black Rock Coalition member. Sapphire is a well-regarded poet and author whose first novel, Push, was adapted for film and released as Precious, the Oscar-winning film produced by Lee Daniels and our episode 92 guest, Lisa Cortez.
I saw Nas. First time I heard of Freestyle Fellowship was there. I met Priest there, who eventually became one of the founding members of Antipop Consortium. As I said, Mike Ladd, Blue, Black, and Brown. It was a mixed bag. You know, a lot of rappers came through, as well as, you know, some emerging poets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and was there...
Actress Sonya Sohn came, was a poet.
Oh, nice. Who we now mostly know as an actress.
Yeah. She was a poet. I saw, you know, she, you know, so it was like a complete amalgamation of people, you know, or people who were coming up who are very, like, I guess, prominent now, you know, who are doing their thing. So
yeah, we talked to Raquel Cepeda a little bit about scene.
Yeah, she used to be there.
So can you talk a little bit about, like, the, I know you had the Rap Meets Poetry was literally the title of one of the events. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between rap and poetry at that time? Was there like a hard and fast line? Did they kind of blur together?
For me, it was no difference. It was just a matter of cadence, you know, but there was some distinction, you know, based on certain people's approach, how they approach their, how they approach their writing and how they express their writing, like physical, how they express their writing physically. But for me, it was no clear distinction. You know, you rap a certain way because you're dependent on a beat, but in that particular platform, it was all a cappella. So you had to kind of change and phrase your words. It kind of opened me up, actually, like lyrically, you know, because I came from like mostly like White Plains. Like I used to work with this guy named, well, not work with him, but I used to work with this, I used to be around this dude named Top Quality. Prominent MC from White Plains. He had signed a deal with PMD Records, and like I grew up, like DMX was like, you know, the, because he was in Yonkers, I was grew up in White Plains, so you know, you grow up listening to DMX like demo tapes. Every time I see ya, another won't I be ya, just like me ya, the capital figure, M to the XS, no, I'm not a sexist, nationally known from New York to Texas. So I grew up kind of like, you know, on some rap, and then when I started, like, I got exposed to the poetry scene through this girl, and she took me to, like, the Narikin, and then, you know, I started, like, getting up there, and I had to approach it a little differently because it wasn't the beat, and it was more emphasis on the words and the writing. So it kind of opened me up, really, to, you know, becoming a better writer, really.
The stuff you were performing in the early 90s and kind of when that scene was around, how was it different than the raps people would hear from you, you know, once APC got started?
It was less experimental and more personal, you know, but I started to experiment because it was a cappella. So I tried to do interesting things. Like there was one point I wrote this piece called The Serpent, and I had like a little shaker and a sock, and I had written the words on the sock, and then was performing and reading the words off the sock and miming the snake, you know, just interesting things like that. Like I would ride my bike on the stage and then like recite poems like while riding my bike, you know, like little things, little like performance things. I try to do, make it like little things to stand out, you know.
That's great. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, you grew up in White Plains, obviously right near Yonkers, also right near New Rochelle. Were you aware of Brand Nubian before they broke?
Yeah. The early Sadat X, like, I grew up being very influenced by the early Sadat X freestyle tapes. Now you're waiting, now it's finally came. Last but not least, you called out the name. As it said, you always save the best for last. So now you'd be amazed as I teach the classes. I commit to start the rocket. That this, my friend Al, I had this friend named Al, and he was the one that convinced me. Like, originally I came into the game trying to be a DJ. I was at Black Expo one time, and they were doing like a free giveaway of like how to scratch, and you had to enter like this raffle, whatever. So you win this videotape of this raffle of Red Alert and Spinderella showing you how to scratch. And I had this dude named this friend named Harold, and he had equipment, you know. So I grew up like Harold used to throw parties like in my cousin's house in Connecticut, and you know, I used to like rock like house parties with Harold and this other DJ named John. So I came into the game trying to be a DJ.
Did you have a good DJ name?
Something Rolo, something really horrible, something very young. But yeah, I came in trying to be a DJ, and I couldn't really afford the equipment. It was like too much money at the time. So it was Al who said I was the first, who was the first person said, yo, you should try and rhyme. And Al used to like give me all these some of the Park Jam stuff that he had on tape. And he also like exposed me to a lot of like early Sadat X freestyle tapes.
Wow.
Like there was also this guy named Key to Speed who used to rhyme. He did some stuff with early Brand Nubian in Sadat X.
Say you look 20, I'm only 18. On the mic, I know you like because my rap is so mean.
He had recently died, like maybe like a year or so ago. And yeah, I was influenced a lot by early Sadat X and early Gangstar. When Gangstar was 2 MCs, like when he was Keithy E, and it was also Damo Deesky. You know, that song Bust a Move.
So you can deal with all the business at hand and blend with the music like you know you can. Cause it's time to go all out smooth so you can prove it's nothing but a small thing. So bust a move, boy.
Those my early influences.
Wow, that's so interesting because I feel like on your records, you know, the influences that really come through are even prior to that are kind of like the pre-Run DMC era of hip-hop. You know, you'll name drop Wild Style or Busy Bee or Cold Crush.
Chief Rocker like Busy Bee, but you stupid, don't forget well card, a crush hole, fresh wild flower.
I feel like that era kind of comes through a lot more as far as actually paying homage on your records.
All right. You know, one of my favorite joints is Rap's New Language, you know. I believe it's Treacherous 3, you know, that's one of my favorite joints.
Remember me and Timo D, the man is at the T.O.P. I'm Spoonie G, as you can see, I rock the West Society, and at the end you will agree, nobody rock the mic like me. But special case is Timo D, you add us up with Legal 3. And on the mic, we turn it down.
You know, but my first record I ever bought was with, you know, was Planet Rock. So that sound has never really left me.
Mm. So I saw you mention just one time a group that you were in before Antipop Consortium. I think the name was like Treaded Measures or something.
Yeah, Treaded Measures.
What was
taking
that?
Taking rap in every direction and measures. You know, that, yeah, it was actually the dude I used to, I came up with, Top Quality, who I mentioned earlier. His cousin was the DJ, his cousin Kevin, and this other dude named Rick. But it was just us. It used to be us three. And we opened like some shows for like Top Quality, like in White Plains. Yeah, but you know, it was local. It was like local rap stuff.
What were you rhyming like back then? Do you remember?
Actually, because of I always wanted to do things a little different, so I started experimenting a little bit. I think I was starting to find my voice, and then as I was with Treaded Measures. And then I got exposed to the poetry scene, and I was like, let me try and go in this direction. And they kind of wanted to stay where they were. So I was trying to really just find my voice at that point.
You know, somewhere in all that, you ended up meeting and eventually working with Vernon Reed.
Vernon Reed is a musician and producer most notable for his founding of the rock band Living Color, which won multiple Grammys and even opened for the Rolling Stones. Also a founder of Black Rock Coalition with Greg Tate and Conda Mason, he's worked in many different genres of music and has done work with Beans, Pharoah Munch, and Immortal Technique, among countless others. He's also no glamour boy. He's fierce.
Yeah, like around the same time.
Wow.
Around the same time as I got exposed to the poetry thing. That's when I first met Vernon. I met Vernon at... We used to do this stuff with through Giant Step called Soup, and it was like once a month. It was like six poets, and we used to do these things through Giant Step once a month at the Supper Club.
Yeah,
and I think it was Greg Tate who introduced me to Vernon, and he came to the Supper Club gig, and that's how I met him. Yeah,
and so you toured and recorded with him. Actually did a few tracks with him.
Vernon's my big brother. You know, Vernon's the one that first took me around the world, showed me the ropes, you know, what it's like, you know, as a touring and being a working musician. Vernon gave me a lot of opportunities, and I'm very thankful to him for that.
Yeah.
He saw something in me, so that was cool.
Yeah, I saw a conversation between you two that you did for Brooklyn Television for Brick, and He said, he described this, what you were doing, as like that it was something coming close to like a punk rap.
Was the phrase he used. I was doing this thing that was kind of predates Death Grips.
My stone wall is all dope, gaze dark tech to the ceiling, stuck okay, make me early. Okay, feel me, I'm in an 800.
Where it was kind of like had that approach. But I never really recorded any of it, so you know, I can't really. I did it. I used to do it live, but you know, it kind of predates that approach.
Interesting. Did you feel at the time like that was something new?
It was. I mean, no one was doing that. I mean, this is like, I mean, when I was coming up, you know, everyone was wearing jerseys and whatnot, you know, football jerseys and trying to sound like Premier. So, you know, I mean, I was touring with Vernon Reid doing like rock stuff and getting exposed to like a lot of like free jazz and poetry.
So. Yeah. And I don't know if this comes out of being in the poetry scene or whatever, but I think especially in the early anti-pop stuff, but, you know, throughout your career, there's never been a super heavy emphasis on end rhyme, right? On rhyming stuff at the end of a line.
Oh, no. Not really, no.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about rhyme and, like, the role that plays in your raps?
Oh, I try to treat it playfully. I try to, you know, I figure that there's really no rules other than the rules and the parameters that you set for yourself. So, for me, it's kind of anything goes, really, lyrically. It's kind of anything goes in terms of... I guess I could describe it as being... Being cryptic yet confessional. I guess that's a good way to describe my style. Somewhat experimental, but also can be very personal at the same time.
Yeah. And, you know, when you came together with the other guys in Antipop, what do you think it was that made it work as a group? Like, what each of you do? How does that sort of complement each other?
Well, part of the reason is that none of us really sounded the same. We didn't have one particular style. We all sounded in various, we all sounded very varied from each other. You know, we all had a specific approach to doing the same thing, but it was all sort of experimental. And it was a lot of those same differences that kind of worked, you know, when we came and made those tracks. We had, at the time we had different agendas, but we still managed to be very, creative and responsive to each other within those particular bodies of work that we've done within the time that was allotted for the group.
Right. You know, the group sounded so different than anything else that was going on at the time. Who did you see as like your antecedents artistically?
We were trying to make music that was in the vein of like the early 80s pioneers where everything was different. You know, we came up and exposed to a time when hip hop was De La, Bismarck, Big Daddy Kane, Public Enemy, you know, MC Light. You know, we came up in the era where, you know, everything was varied. It was daily, you know, it was nothing sounded the same, but yet it was still under the umbrella of hip hop. So we just tried to make music in the spirit of that, you know, just trying to, you know, be true to the foundation of what we saw hip hop was being and then expand upon it by, you know, going back and incorporating like live drum machines and like and synths so that the music would be original and it would be our own and being less dependent on borrowing or sampling from other people's music. So we tried to make it and be as original as possible, but also staying to the foundations of what we knew hip hop to be. So, also during that time when hip hop, I would say like with anti-pop, we met kind of like in the early 90s at this poetry scene, you know, so we were kind of being exposed like to opening up like lyrically, but, we were also doing shows through Sound Lab. Sound Lab used to do like a lot of raves and stuff. That's kind of where like Howard and Beth Coleman and like DJ Spooky and like kind of the Illbient scene. Like Bizarre, you know, some people like that. So we were doing shows with Sound Lab, you know, and we would do this instrumental kind of thing. Well, not instrumental really, but we had this little side band called the Blank Slates. And it was like Priest online sampler, me on drum machines doing vocals. This guy named Manny Megman, who was playing like synths, and his saxophonist named Michael Goth. And we were doing a lot of raves and stuff. And that was kind of forming like kind of the formulative sound of, anti-pop, as well as being exposed to like, you know, the Sonic Youth, the Chicone Youth album specifically. That album opened us up a lot, and you know, also like Sun Ra wanted to do the early Mantronics drum machine program and stuff. you know, and also being still influenced by like the Planet Rock era, but still being lyrically like proficient as like the early 80s era MCs of like, you know, the G-Raps. You know, the KRSs, the Canes.
Let it roll, get bold. I just can't hold back a fold, cause I'm a man with soul and control and effects. So what the heck? Rock the discotheques and this groove is what.
So we tried to incorporate all those things together and really came up with the sound of what Antipop became.
Right. You know, when Antipop would perform, there was always like a improvisational element sort of baked into what you were doing, right?
Yeah, and that had a lot to do with being doing stuff through Sound Lab, because we played live and we were just accustomed to doing it, mm-hmm. you know, in that way. So
interesting. And you know, the thing about one of the things about Antipop that was interesting is like a lot of American acts before who were maybe a little left of center, you guys broke in the UK.
Yeah.
Before America. And you kind of knew that was going to happen, right? You spent your own money to get to the UK the first time.
Yeah. We spent our own money when the first person to ever really put us on was Giles Peterson. He was the first person to play the Disorientation single.
First of all, my mission is to be clear. Secondly, slide over so my brethren can slide up from the rear. Can't make sense out of me.
Physically, that speaks for itself, disorientation.
In case you don't understand.
Disorientation.
Physically, that speaks for itself.
Still, got this rhyme flow by the throat.
Live like wet fingers in the socket.
And this was like, I want to say like 96, 97.
I would say, yeah, that single was a couple of years before the first album, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was the first, Giles Peterson gave us our break. You know, he was the first one, you know.
What made you confident enough to risk your own funds to go over to the UK that first time? What made you sure you were going to find an audience?
The response after the single came out, mm-hmm. people loved Disorientation. You know, it was like, yo, this is a wicked tune. And we, you know, made some long-lasting friendships there, like Roger Robinson, who plays in King Midas Sound. We stayed with Roger, and then Roger was just like, yo, it's blowing, it's doing well. And he organized, like, little shows for us to come through and that, met Giles and everything. So, yeah, I mean, it was just people were just really responsive and, like, felt strong about it. And then it kind of, like, bubbled over here gradually, so.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, somewhat ironically, your favorite APC album is the one that almost no one heard because it was only released in Japan.
Shopping carts, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about the
actually
the story
my favorite Antipop album, I think, is the last one, Fluorescent Black.
Ring around the rosy, your pocket full of posy. Fluorescent Black, turn the ashes, MC want to oppose me. I can say a word.
Oh, okay. The reunion one from 2009.
Yeah. But I like Shopping Cars. Shopping Cars has some joints on it.
So what? Why did that record never end up getting released in America?
Oh, because that was the intent. You know, the intent was for it to be Japanese only. You know?
Really? You made a full album with
just for Japanese only. Yeah.
Wow.
That record took like 3 weeks to make. We made that record in like 3 weeks.
Wow. What was why just
like,
there?
Like produced, written, everything was done in like 3 weeks.
Wow. Why make a record just for Japan?
Oh, the label, I think it was Nippon Crown, mm-hmm. the label that put it out. They contacted us to do a record, and that's just how it happened. It just became like a Japanese only record.
So strange. Yeah, I feel like that one. You've talked about how that record sort of like showed your evolution in a certain way that maybe like people who haven't heard it.
It's kind of the missing link.
Yeah.
Unto itself it's incomplete, but made complete by my connection. The effervescent vestige of decimation, the decimal point, 0.007%. Possession with the intent to make bank, I break bread with tag heads.
It's a nice showcase between Tragic and like the EPs before we signed to Warp.
Mm.
You know, it shows that the evolution is kind of a missing link because it's kind of a drastic step between Tragic and then you go to like Ends Against the Middle and you kind of like what happened there and what happened there with Shopping Carts. So, you know, Shopping Carts, I'm proud of Shopping Carts because not only was it done efficiently in an expedient amount of time, but I think it was good work. And, you know, we started to really, I think it's definitely a bridge to the later work that we did with Ends Against the Middle, leading up to Arrhythmia. So
right, and Arrhythmia, I think, is, you know, certainly probably your most popular record.
Maybe. Yeah, Arrhythmia is.
Why do you think that one reached, you know, more people than the other ones? So was something about the record, or was it just you were on a new label? Like, what about it?
It was a combination of being on a legacy label like Warp, and as well as some of the, you know, more poppier approach tunes like Bubbles and Ping Pong. You know, people seem to really respond to that in Ghost Lawns.
Center the town into the domain, no main propane flame or butane to the opening with an offering. It's not often that I wanna, but I'm gonna make a point as I wanna for the so and so's and bows on tiptoes. Spit flows, hypno, crypto, cryogenic pieces.
People seem to be really responsive to those specific songs on Arrhythmia.
Mm-hmm.
I like Arrhythmia. I'm proud of Arrhythmia, but my favorite anti-pop record is the last one.
Well, we'll get to how that came about after a long hiatus in a second, but the album you did with Matthew Shipp, the piano player, that was so, it's so interesting. Like, obviously you've been
and I like this. I'm not sorry to interrupt, but I like the second one album to that. First one was kind of, I'll tell you the story, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I was gonna say, like, you'd obviously been working with live musicians, you know, since your days, you know, playing in raves, like you mentioned, with a saxophonist. What was it like recording with you know, with a pianist?
Well, it's the first time was kind of weird because when Thirsty Ears had approached us to do this Matthew Shipp, like, be part of the Blue Series, what had happened is that we were breaking up at the time.
Right. I was going to say that was released, I think, maybe while you were on hiatus.
We weren't even really speaking at the time. So a lot of the first Matthew Shipp album was very haphazard. You know, like, it was a lot of catch up because, how you do those records is Thirsty Ear would record, like, they would rent out a studio and then they record everything all in one take. Cause that's how jazz people are used to doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They get in.
Then he would just play.
Yeah. They would just play like all day. And then what you would have to do is you would have to take those tapes and chop them up and then make them into joints. So it's a tedious way of doing it.
Right.
It's very tedious, but
Did you direct him at all? Did you say, like, I want things in this mood?
Oh, yeah,
tempo?
He's very open to direction and all that, you know.
Yeah.
He's very open to direction, but it's just a matter of you have to be in sync when you do those records, because if you're not talking to each other while you're trying to, like, chop those records up, it doesn't really come across.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people may or may not like that record, but I didn't like it because at the time of making it, it brings back a lot of memories of turmoil and trying to get it happen and of trying to make it happen because, you know, we weren't even really speaking to each other. And, like, you know, somebody would have, like, these joints and then I would try and do these joints to, like, Band-Aid tracks. And it never really reached this full conception of what it was supposed to be because we weren't on speaking terms.
Well, I mean, luckily you got to do a full record with live players a little later on.
Yeah, that I'm pleased with that one. The Nas from Heaven one, I'm pleased with that.
And then a voice says, P, are you gonna buckle from the waiter? Grown man, B.I., show him what you're made of. Bars imitated, but never stated the way I innovated, stayed on some other I needn't say. I get it, but I get it through patterns hoping you.
So one of the biggest things that Antipop did was sort of ironically towards the very end of the group or before your hiatus, you guys opened up for Radiohead.
Yeah.
During the Amnesiac tour.
Yeah.
What did you learn from watching them perform every night?
They were constant professionals. There was one show that went with The Hitch, but how they handled it was like, they were constant professionals. You know, this is during, like, we were playing, we were in Germany opening for them during 9/11. So 9/11 to me is kind of surreal because I was watching it on TV. And opening for them while it was happening.
Wow.
So the whole thing was kind of surreal for me. And then we had to stay in Europe for like a couple weeks extra after the tour because we weren't allowed back into the country. So
sure.
This was like, you know, so it was kind of not a whole 9/11 for me is somewhat surreal, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine. And, you know, so the group splits up. And I saw an interview with you like 03, and you were pretty down on the idea of ever getting back together, at least at that point.
What happens, we were overseas, I think we were in Norway or something, and I had just left my daughter's mom, and I had just signed. What happened when we signed the deal to Warp? Warp had rights to first refusals on any of our solo releases.
Right.
So when we signed to Warp, like maybe 2 or 3 weeks after we signed, I gave them a demo because we were always working on individual stuff. So even before Arrhythmia came out, I already had a solo deal with Warp. I already knew I was going to come out with Warp, and the others could have did the same thing. So here I am about to be kicked out of my house, and I split up. So I was really depressed, and we were touring. We were doing this festival in Norway, and this was like around my birthday. And I think we were taking a ferry from Denmark to Norway. And I was just like, yo, I think I spoke to Priest, and I was just like, listen, you know, things in my life are really like, you know, are really up in arms. You know, things are really like really very traumatic for me. And I think I want to try and do something artistically different than what's happening with Antipop. I wanted to, you know, I already had the deal, so I wanted to, like, work on my solo stuff. I was telling him this as my friend. I wasn't trying to leave the group because I thought it would be really stupid. Like, we just came off this Radiohead.
Right, giant tour.
Yeah, this giant tour.
Yeah.
Why would I think of breaking up? I just wanted to take some time out to, like, work on my own material. So they kind of took that as, like, you know, they kind of took that as though I was leaving the group, but I wasn't. I was just wanted to just like take some time out because of the timing. I mean, if you're going to do this giant tour and then, you know, you individuals come out, it works for everybody because it shows that we can all bubble off this. And that's just where my thinking was. And, you know, so we get back from this tour. My manager is like, the guys in the band want to have a meeting. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they was like, yo, they want to break up. I was like, what are you talking about? Why would you? So I was shocked.
Yeah.
So we had this meeting and I was like, yo, I don't really know. I understand where you guys are coming from. It's really, you know, the timing sucks. So then maybe I get a call from the manager, like maybe like four days later telling me that we broke up. And that's how the first time we broke up. That's how it happened.
Yeah, no wonder you didn't really, at least at that point, have an outlook on getting back together.
I didn't talk to them for like five years.
Wow.
I didn't talk to them for like 5 years.
What got you back in contact and kind of led to the group reforming?
Well, I was doing my thing solo wise. You know, I put out all those like Warp releases.
Yeah.
After I left Warp, maybe like 2 years after that, I was seeing this woman. And she had actually contacted them for my birthday, and they showed up. I didn't know that they were coming. We got into a conversation about doing more work together, and that's kind of how it happened.
Wow.
Yeah, and it happened rather quick, actually. Like, I mean, like maybe like a month or so after we had that conversation, Pitchfork announced that we had gotten back together.
How did it feel to see that pop up in the media?
It was good. The momentum helped because, like, before we did Fluorescent Black, we were touring like for like 2 years straight.
Right.
You know, getting reacclimated with one another while working on Fluorescent Black.
And the actual process of making that record, how was it, or was it different than the process of making the earlier records?
Well, we had to really get to know each other again, you know. I'm not really the big producer person in Antipop, you know. It's mostly I left it to Priest and Saeed, you know, and we kind of like, it was more, those records really were more Priest, Earl Blaze, and myself. Saeed contributed to a track or so, then he would put his like 2 cents in later. But most of the construction of those records was just mainly the three of us.
Can you talk about Earl Blaze for a second? Because I know he did some of the beats, but he also, you know, engineered pretty much everything,
he's
right?
Engineered all those Antipop records.
Yeah.
All those Antipop records were done in Earl Blaze's house in New Lots.
What did he bring to the group?
He brought the sound, because basically what would happen is even if we were to produce something. If any one of us were to produce a track, we would record it. He would never let us record at the same time. We always had to record separately. You know, he was very stringent about that.
Interesting. Even on the first record where you're like trading every four bars or whatever.
Like scared cattle running through the brand name brand and so-and-so's won labels. They will be scarred by the heat ray.
Impaired contaminants, shrinking your physical inventory from my acid filled toy squirt gun terminology without barrier.
The thing about the first record was this. At the time I was living in London. I was in London for like, you know, I just toured with Vernon. And I was like, let me just go to London real quick for like a couple of weeks. Ended up staying there for like half a year. So while I was living in London, they had already started work on Tragic Epilogue. So like Priest came over to visit me while we were in London. And he had brought with him like Rinse Flow and like Schmores and like Laundry. And they had already started working on like the formative tracks for the Tragic Epilogue. So by the time I came back, that's when we kind of finished things up.
Wow.
But, you know, they mostly started that without me.
That's so interesting, especially, like I said, you know, you guys are trading so much on that record in very sort of short bursts.
Because I heard it, I was like, oh, snap. This, you know, then they started, and then it just became built on, I think it was like, started as like 8 songs, and then we built on it after I came back, you know.
So. Wow. And, you know, during the period where you were touring, you guys had a tour that was you, Cool Keith, Edan, and Public Enemy. That's a lot of characters to have on one tour.
Nah, it was good. I was starstruck with Chuck D. You
know, sure.
Chuck D changed my life, you know, being like 14, 15, hearing Public Enemy for the first time, exposing me to, you know, to historic cultural black figures and reading and researching, discovering who I am. I joined African Minds at the same time. The community center was going to see various lectures through African Minds and different, you know, scholars speaking on the black experience here in America. And
what is African Minds?
It was like a youth group that I was part of when I was in high school, you know, and it actually was listening to Public Enemy that made me seek out those things. So, you know, he changed my life. He seriously changed my life. So I didn't really know what to say to him. I was kind of starstruck to be on the same stage with Public Enemy.
What's the status of the group now?
Which group?
Of Antipop.
I'm no longer involved in Antipop.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly couldn't tell you what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not really on speaking terms. I haven't really spoken to Priest in maybe like a year and a half. I know Saeed moved to Paris. You know, he's an expat. And Earl, I saw Earl in July. He, you know, surprised me on my birthday. But I have no involvement in the group for the past like maybe 2 or 3 years.
Okay, what happened to and the sort of reforming of the original lineup?
What happened was I'll put it to you like this: there was a personal issue that I had. I'll say like my fish caught polio, right? And I just don't want to get into what the personal issue was.
Yeah.
But I'll say my fish caught polio.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So my fish caught polio and I wasn't able to do a certain amount of touring. They knew full well that my fish caught polio and I wasn't able to do this. I was communicating with them via email and they felt that the way that I was communicating with them was somewhat disingenuous. So when I was, you know, when my fish was feeling better and I started to tour, this is my own personal idea of what happened.
Sure.
You know, I think that the personal kind of led to the, interfered with the professional. I don't really feel that it was really a professional thing that happened. And since my fish had caught polio, knowing that I was coming back, knowing full well that certain things could have been remanded once I came back and handled differently, and the bigger vision should have been on the music and what people had wanted instead of making it more of a personal issue that, you know, interfered with us working together. But, you know, it is what it is. And I was already somewhat, you know, gun shy about working with them, you know, because when you're working in a group, you know, you have to go through certain compromises. It's not easy to deal with other people, and different people work differently. So I haven't really had any contact with them. I don't really know what they're doing musically. The last thing I heard from them was they were working with this artist named Lorez in Paris, where he had hired them to do a soundtrack to one of his artistic ventures. I think what had happened is he had rented a submarine, and then he went into the bottom of the ocean to film these bioluminescent fish. Mm-hmm. And he had hired Antipop to do, like, the soundtrack for it.
There is this thing about the deep sea I remember reading during my research. It was an interview with some scientist who works for a kind of administration's oceanographic acoustic monitoring project in the Pacific Northwest. He's one who spends his days figuring out the sounds of the deep.
So that was the last thing that I knew that they did musically.
Right.
And, other than that, I have no idea.
Sure.
I have no idea.
Sure. And I wanted to ask a few things about your solo career. With the Shock City Maverick project, I noticed, like, the first few tracks on it, especially very, very aggressive, like, battle rhyme type stuff.
The inclination of an eraser to eliminate all written factors. So sharp was my action, a thumbtack in a toilet seat. Sleek and chic, a beauty of a beast on a beat. On a mic, he's nice and nice, your brand precise. Spark when you fumbled in the dark. I did it because you did it.
What was your state of mind when approaching that album?
Well, I felt after Tomorrow Right Now, when Tomorrow Right Now first came out, I felt it was somewhat after Antipop, like, broke up for the, like, split for the first time. I knew I had to do a record quick. And I had, like, started working on this stuff. I guess Antipop broke up in June, and I, like, handed in Tomorrow Right Now, like, in, like, September or something. So yeah. I knew that I had to do it quick in order to stay in the minds of people, you know, who were familiar with Antipop, and so I could, like, work and whatnot. So that was my whole thing with Tomorrow Right Now. It was like, yo, I had to get this out, you know, before people forget. I can't, like let a year lapse or whatever.
Yeah.
So then I went right away after Tomorrow Right Now. I went right away to the studio and did the EP, Now Soon Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So I just knew that, you know, for me to work and to tour and to constantly be active and as a musician, you know, you gotta constantly put out output. So that was my whole thing with Shock City. You know, I just wanted to just, like, I just wanted to make a bomb-ass record that I knew that I could constantly keep me working.
Mm-hmm. And the only album which you did with the rhythm section of Hamid Drake and William Parker.
Alone but never lonely beans, you're my one and only, you're my only, holy moly, new thunder, clunk killer, craftmatic, alphabetic, acrobatic, back hit on crack water, coolest 43, make a zillion Fonzarellis, all my parts equal to any song greater than you, you waste the paper, recycle.
How did that work? How did you record that, first off?
Same thing as the Nas from Heaven, same thing as the first Matthew Shipp verse Antipop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Thirsty Air rents out a room, they rent out a studio for like a day. And then they you have to chop up the record, and they give you like a month and a half to try and hand in that record. So it's like they're constantly like, yo, where's the record? You know, my only regret with Only is that I should have rhymed more on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like 10 tracks, and I rhymed out of 5 tracks because I was trying to showcase myself as like as something to deviate from just rapping on every track, which I kind of regret, like, looking back on. I should have rhymed on every track.
Did you rhyme differently because you had a live, or at least the performances of a live rhythm section to rhyme over?
I think I was trying to get more in a producer head, you know, which is why I kind of, like, let certain tracks breathe without lyrics. You know, mm-hmm. I was trying to showcase another side of me, but I should have just rhymed on it. You know, that's my biggest regret with Only. I should have just, like, every track, it should have had a rhyme on. I think it would have made for... I think it would have made for people better for people to, like, appreciate it if they had more lyrics on it, you know. Yeah. So it wouldn't have been such a disconnect from, like, the canon of my other material. So I should have just rhymed more on it.
Yeah. So there's a line on that record that really jumped out at me on 118. You say, indie rock loves me, but I ain't cooning for white kids or lying about crimes I ain't did.
Indie rock loves me, but I ain't cooning for white kids or lying about crimes I ain't did. I don't step aside, I step up. So if you speak and shut up.
Yeah.
And I guess I just wanted to use that as a little jumping off point to get your thoughts on kind of the racial makeup of some of your audiences, be it like at a small level or at you know, a giant thing like during the Radiohead tour. Is it ever awkward or weird performing in front of majority white audiences?
No, not really. No, it's not an issue. It's just a statement on the state of where indie hip hop was going.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and what do you mean by that? Where indie hip hop is going?
Well, in the early 90s, when we came up, you know, it was supported a lot by majority of black audiences. But, you know, it was somehow like during the 90s, early 2000s, there was a shift that happened. So it was just being observant of that, what that shift was.
Do you have any idea like what contributed to that, or you have thoughts or theories about it?
Taste changed. You know, I think, in the late 90s, you know, a lot of crappy like pop rap shit. You know, as 2000s happened, pop actually became better. It was actually got a lot better. So it was just like, I think it was just that shift.
And, you know, you had an album called End It All.
Yeah.
And it was called that because you actually were thinking about ending it all, not everything, but your music career.
Yeah, I was going to retire.
After that record. What made you want to quit at that time, and what made you change your mind?
What made me change my mind? I don't really remember what made me change my mind, to be honest with you. But at that time, I was pretty adamant about it, that this is, you know, I was going to make my final statement with this record. But to be honest with you, I don't really know if I can quit now. I mean, even if five people hear it, I'll probably still put out music.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking to that dynamic, you have, you know, your song Crave, where the hook talks about too many MCs and not enough listeners.
A deeper sense is what the listeners crave, because there's too many MCs and not enough listeners. A deeper sense is...
I feel like that's a line that is more relevant now than ever. What...
Yeah,
was there
true.
A particular thing that inspired you to write that line?
Just felt there was a lot of whack dudes coming out. There's a lot of whackness coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's like too many MCs and not enough listeners. Especially like in the early 90s when everyone thought they could freestyle and smoke a blunt and freestyle. I was worse, man, because it was a lot of smoke courage, you know, and without any follow through, you know, to be proficient in the craft and just... It was terrible.
The song Hardliner, on the recording, the name of the person, your person or group that you're...
Person
you're dissing is censored.
Speaking of that, in his wag. We share the same stage of the Knitting Factory with TTC. Homie, you ain't impressing me. Please give up the ghost as compost. But enough about that. Ask the universe.
You say, you talk about someone, you know, being bad on stage.
Cadence
during
Weapon.
A show. Cadence Weapon. Okay.
From Canada.
Good to know. Why did you mask the name at the time?
To be clever.
Mm-hmm. Just to keep people guessing?
Yeah, it was a show at the Knitting Factory with TTC, and I was like, yo, this dude is garbage.
And you have a tendency to be really, you know, personal on a lot of your songs. Obviously, there's something like Crevice that talks about, you know, family illness and your dad's passing.
Raised with the brother, sister, mama found the answer. God grabbed my pops by the arm, a leg of cancer. Now these events...
Plenty of other examples, things like Blind Driver, even, you know. Where does that confessional impulse come from?
I think that goes back to, like, being exposed to, like, the poetry scene. Because I think that, you know, in order to... I always thought that the best poets were the most vulnerable, the most exposition of scars. It just makes for better work in art when you're just honest when you just see people who are honest with themselves, and then it shows up and they're honest with their material. I think the greatest artists are very vulnerable, you know? So it's just a matter of like being very sincere with what I'm trying to say.
And, you know, one of your best known solo pieces is Booger Sugar.
Stealing from my loved one shows what I'm made of. Shit. So bust another hit, because the more I inhale, the more delete brain cells, but never sweating what I forgot due to forgetting.
Going back to, you know, the poetry scene.
Right. That's in sort of a spoken word kind of style.
Yeah.
Without getting too personal, and you certainly don't have to talk about this, is that autobiographical?
Not at all. It's from my mom used to work at a homeless shelter in Yonkers, and I used to work there like in the soup kitchen, like, you know, cleaning up and like giving the homeless food. So that's kind of where that came from.
That's so interesting because it's in the first person. I feel like I've actually read in press how it was about your life. It's so interesting how putting something in the first person just convinces people.
Well, also
it has to
too,
be true.
But also too, I was also dealing with my own things. Like, you know, I used to smoke a lot of weed and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was just dealing with, you know, a woulda, coulda, shoulda. Like, if I could see myself doing this, where would it go? What would happen? And, you You know, so it's kind of dealing with that as well. So
yeah. And your record Thorns, obviously, speaking of, you know, confessional personal work, the band Holy Fuck backs you up on a few songs.
Yeah.
They are, one of the things that's famous about them is they never rehearse, right? Everything's, everything's in the moment.
We rehearsed once.
Wow.
Before we played like Coachella. I played Coachella with them. We rehearsed like once.
Okay. So they rehearsed before giant festivals, but no other. So you didn't run through any of the material prior to recording with them?
No. No. They sent me, what I did is I did the production and then they played on top of it. For those tracks on Thorns, and they just added to it.
So interesting. And one of the things about your approach musically that makes you unique is you take this kind of like early 80s, you know, Bambata style, Mantronic style, electro. But then you also have the, you know, several decades prior, avant-garde, music concrete, Edgar Varese. Kind of like approach. What gave you the idea to kind of build a bridge between those two, to meld those two?
Well, if you look at Mantronix and what Mantronix did during that time, you know that Autechre is an extension of what Mantronix was doing. So for me, it was all one thing, you know, Autechre is the child of Mantronix. Mm-hmm. So if you look at it like that, then you see the lineage. So it was kind of the same thing, you know, that's, you know, I always saw it as like, I always really just liked those sounds and always wanted to incorporate those sounds and that approach into hip hop, you know, because like in the 90s, everything was all sample based. And I just really just wanted something that was original. And that's really kind of what I thought was kind of missing with like the drum machines, like we're going back to drum machines, finding drum machines and programming and then playing. And, you know, I thought that live element, that human element was kind of missing from sample based music because it's all dependent on what other people already did. And I always thought that, you know, in order to bring something new to it, you kind of have to kind of play it.
Right. So interesting. And, especially on the first Antipop album, on Tragic Epilogue, you use a lot of alliteration on that record.
Heat ray. Curses. Boil your dirty dish deeds like aluminum. Difficult to dislodge. Bewilderment engraved on face.
How did that sort of work its way into your style?
I don't know. Just a matter of progressing. And as I said, you know, we had somewhat of an agenda. And the agenda when we first came out was to really like, we wanted to really do something that was really distinct, that was the sum of our influences and, you know, and something that we can claim and call our own, really.
After we talked, Beans wrote to us about this question. He said, "You asked me a question about alliteration, and I'm not sure I answered you correctly during the interview, but I got influenced to incorporate that style of writing from listening to Redman's verse on EPMD's Hardcore.
Redman ready to rock rough rhymes. Renegade rapper, rip when it's rhyme time. Punk push a pin and pounce to when I'm pissed. Back pissed through posse, flow some more pro shit. B-5-4-5, funky to floor 8. Fucking freak words for foreplay. Quickly, quiet is kept, never quack. On a Q-tip I quote, I throw lines like a quarterback. A monster, murder mother.
One of your influences is actually a past guest on this show, Devon Styler.
Oh, yeah.
In particular, his second album, The Spiral Walls.
Yeah, Spiral Walls.
Containing Autumn's of Light.
His new one's cool, too.
Yeah. Why is that album, though, that second one in particular, so special to you?
Because it's one of the most... It's one of the most avant-garde hip-hop records ever made. There was no record ever sound like that. Mystic Sheep Drink Electric Tea, you know, Gray Matter, you know, Hell Doesn't Want, you know, Heaven Doesn't Want Me, Hell's Afraid I'll Take Over. Tracks are amazing. those tracks are amazing, and they predate and kind of set the parameter for what Antipop did, you know, also for Def Grips, you know, Mystic Sheet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it predates all that.
Yeah.
The album was ahead of its time. It was far flung, you know.
Definitely out there.
Yeah.
Record. Maybe not that many people have heard, but everyone who's heard it, it's had a tremendous impact on.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't even done stuff like as like far flung as that. But,
yeah.
You know, his last two records were cool, especially that one he did on Mo-Wax.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good record. And the new one from Gamma was cool, too.
Yeah.
The Death Mask thing. It's cool.
Yeah. You know, one of the songs actually of yours that reminded me the most of Spiral Walls was Gold Skull.
Things I wanted to say.
Such a raw song, very like chanting kind of. What was behind that song?
Just trying things, you know, trying and failing. Mm-hmm. That's what this whole music thing is trying and failing, at least, you know, not trying and not being afraid to fail, you know. So
yeah. And a few years ago you said you were working on a book called Navigating to Nowhere.
Yeah, it actually became Die Tonight. I finished it.
Is it out in the world?
No, not yet. I hope to have it come out like this summer.
Right.
Like this summer, I'm putting out like three releases. It'll be Wolves of the World, Love Me Tonight, and Host. I think I'm still working on the third one. But the first two are done.
Wow, Love Me Tonight. You mentioned that back in the interview you did with Vernon that I saw back in like 2011.
Yeah, Love Me Tonight is done.
What can you tell me about it?
Well, it's a trilogy, you know, and you know, it kind of has a nice beginning and then a kind of a middle sound. Love Me Tonight has sort of a middle sound, and then Host is more experimental. So I'm working on Host now. I think I have like five tracks to finish. Hopefully I'll be done by February, but I'm hoping to put it out sometime in the summer.
Planning on releasing all three of them simultaneously?
Yeah, along with the book. So that's where I've been doing, where I've been disappeared. I've been working on three albums and a book. That's why I haven't put out
a good excuse. Yeah.
Yes. That's why I haven't put anything out, because this is what I've been working on.
Nice. And finally, I knew you grew up as a big Kiss fan.
Yep.
What was your favorite piece of Kiss memorabilia?
Oh, I used to have all the dolls. I had all the dolls.
Wow.
I wish I still had them, but I used to have all the dolls.
Kiss, each 12.5-inch figure sold separately by Mego.
All right. Anything else we should know about obviously you have three albums and a book coming out in the summer. Anything else we should know about? Any tours or anything coming up?
No, I'm just honestly, I'm working on, as I said, you know, the three albums are Wolves of the World, Love Me Tonight, and Haas. The book is called Die Tonight. And then probably in the summer, I'll start the follow-up, which is called Tradecraft. And then the one after that is called Beans is Whack.
That sounds like a great note to end on. Beans, thank you so much for coming through. Great meeting you again for the first time this decade.
That picture is crazy.
Yeah, we have a picture of me and Beans and Mike Ladd in a nightclub somewhere in the middle of Ohio. We will put it on the CypherShow.com for everyone to see, all of us circa probably 2001 or 2002.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As you heard at the end of the show, Beans and I had actually met once before this interview at a nightclub somewhere in Ohio. I think it was probably Cleveland, back in the early 2000s. You can find the photo on our Instagram. I'm really excited that we got to meet up again, this time in far quieter surroundings, to discuss Beans' life and work. I left the conversation with a much improved idea of his style, of his creative choices, of how Antipop Consortium worked, and with a whole bunch of new cool music to listen to. After the interview, Beans emailed us over a very special playlist of songs that were a big influence on him when he was growing up. You can find a link to the playlist on thecyphershow.com. It includes some of the songs he talked about on this episode and a bunch of other amazing stuff as well. Join us next week when our guest will be Quelle Chris. Quelle is a rapper and producer who got his start in the Detroit scene with the Wasted Youth crew before developing into a truly original artist. His songs will make you laugh hysterically right before connecting with your deepest insecurities and emotions. Fans aren't the only ones who have noticed. Quelle has worked with some of the most highly regarded artists out there, people like Black Milk, Rock Marciano, and Jean Grey. Quelle discusses everything from his childhood years in Detroit and St. Louis to his upcoming instrumental album, Lullabies for the Broken Brain. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, like the guy the other day on Twitter who suggested that we should have Madlib on the show, which I think would be an amazing idea, and anything else you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. Again, while you're there, sign up for our mailing list to keep up to date with everything that's going on. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
A lot of smoke courage, you know.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Trying things, you know, trying and failing.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Smoke a blunt and freestyle.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
The greatest artists are very vulnerable.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
I didn't talk to them for like 5 years.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Vikram.
Containing autumn supply.
And to Marcus Pinn of the fantastic blog Pinland Empire for making this interview happen.
There's like too many MCs and not enough listeners.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Ice-T has great taste.